I'm Madeline Deininger, and it's my great pleasure to introduce tonight's poets, decades-long dear friends, first readers, fierce and helpful critics and champions of each other's work. Lawrence Robb will be reading first. A Massachusetts native, born in Pittsfield, Robb has taught at Williams College in Williamstown, Massachusetts since 1976. Excellent vintage. Author of eight, I'm in the wine business, so I get to say that. Author of eight books of poetry and many accolades over the years, his latest book, published just last year, Mistaking Each Other for Ghosts, was a National Book Award long last selection and was selected as one of the 10 best books of poetry of the year by the New York Times. While his New England roots and credentials run deep, Robb works in the international waters of past, present, and future. Lawrence Robb's poems evoke a world both recognizable and dreamlike, a world of slippery realities told from self-questioning perspectives. I marvel at how wonderfully lucid they are in the service of mystery. That's Stephen Dunn commenting on what we don't know about each other, Robb's 1993 collection of poetry that was a finalist for the National Book Award. The poet Tony Hoagland has written, "Pretend that these poems from Lawrence Robb have come to you from very far away." And then he goes on to note, "Robb's poems lead you into, then trap you, in strange worlds, boxes constructed of story, logic, aphorism, and then are revealed to be exactly like life itself." The word resonance is bandied about a lot when critics and lovers of poetry talk about poems they admire. But there's something about Lawrence Robb's writing that predictably gives me chills of enjoyment, revelation, mystery, humor, and what I'll label the ah moment at the end of his poems that, after a short quiet, makes me want to go back to the beginning and start all over again. Lawrence Robb.
Thank you, Maddie. And thank you all for coming. I'm going to begin with a new poem and then read several poems from the book that Maddie mentioned, Mistaking Each Other for Ghosts, which just came out last year. The new poem is called The Afternoon Lesson. And you should imagine an elementary school and one of the students speaking the poem. The teacher referred to is named Mr. Crumley. "Always," Mr. Crumley said, "always be prepared to go to a dark place. We were just kids, but finally Joan asked why. I'm disappointed, Joan," Mr. Crumley replied, "that you have to ask, but I understand. For now, however, just trust me on this one." After that, no one spoke up. "We'll go into it all in more detail later," Mr. Crumley said. "But first, it's time to learn about owls." This didn't seem like a bad idea, given the options. "Owls," Mr. Crumley said, "are passionate and deceptive. They also mate for life. In many ways, they are like us, but better, since they leave us alone, whereas we... but you know how we treat each other, which is one reason to know when to hide, which we'll go into later. In the meantime, never get between a mother bear and her cubs. Never do that. But enough about the natural world." This seemed like a short lesson, shorter than most. I was going to ask if we'd be tested on the material, but I didn't. I think we were all feeling a little uneasy that afternoon. "Now it's time," Mr. Crumley said, "for each of you to draw a map. Making one up is the point of this task. For example, the map I personally want would refuse to confirm my suspicions about where I was, or might be going, or what I could expect to happen when I got there. See what you can do. Naturally, I don't expect perfection, but a little imagination will go a long way in my book." He handed out paper and colored pencils. "And now," he said, "I'm feeling a little under the weather, so I'll just sit behind my desk for a while and think about my life." I'm sure we were all sorry that he was so tired, because in fact we liked Mr. Crumley, strange as he could be. And I know that none of us, with the possible exception of Roger, wanted to believe we were responsible for his weariness, which I could see was a sadness as well, both for himself and for us, for our futures, how someday we might need to hide in a dark place and be afraid, though of what we had not yet been told. And this poem is called "Once But No Longer." Let's say you feel someone off. Let's say you feel someone is better off dead, but you don't do anything about it. That could be a sign of civilization. How you're able to manage such admirable restraint. Say it's Sunday, so you amble down to your garden where the cruelties of life almost vanish. Here you can tell what needs to be uprooted or carefully tended. You understand what must be left alone. This may not be the case the next time you meet Frank at the office, and you think probably a lot of people around here want to kill Frank. Just as much as I do, and none of them will. But it's early afternoon, and you're watching the sunlight wandering around among the ferns, picking out one frond, then another, letting the darker greens flicker into yellow, as if in fact the light was inventing this little dance for you alone, giving you a reason not to kill Frank, while reminding you that men once believed the spores of these very ferns could make a person invisible, then disappear. The speakers of the next poem, or speaker, is one of the sirens from the Odyssey. The poem was originally written in response to a request from editor of an anthology of poems that were going to be all poems that took up a well-known story after the end, which was a great idea. And unfortunately, it never came out. So this poem is spoken by one of the sirens after they left their job being sirens. After a while, we just got tired of singing. One morning out on the rocks with not a ship in sight, we all felt it. A certain weariness, a malaise, if you will. We felt it together, sympathy having become one of the finer aspects of our nature. We've drifted apart since those days, yet we're happy being remembered as impossible to resist. The legends used to claim we knew the future as well. All things which shall be hereafter upon the earth, as our song put it. Everyone only assumed we were beautiful, but we were and are, though not unlike so many other women now, those who promise much less but let you live. It was a relief to give up our powers willingly. That didn't happen often in our world, where the gods went on amusing themselves with their meddling, and the hero plowed ahead, lashed to the mast, dying to be tempted. Did we enjoy the clamor of shipwreck, the cries of the disillusioned? It was our job, our particular talent. We weren't supposed to want anything else. And this one is called Last Day on Earth. If it's the title of a movie, you expect everything to become important. A kiss, a shrug, a glass of wine, a walk with the dog. But if the day is real, life is only as significant as yesterday. The kiss hurried, the shrug forgotten. And now, on the path by the river, you don't notice the sky darkening beyond the pines because you're imagining what you'll say at dinner, swirling the wine in your glass. You don't notice the birds growing silent or the cold towers of clouds moving in because you're explaining how lovely and cool it was in the woods and the dog had stopped limping. She seemed her old self again, sniffing the air and alert, the way dogs are to whatever we can't see. And I was happy, you hear yourself saying, because it felt as if I'd been allowed to choose my last day on earth, and this was the one I chose. Some time ago when I was at one of the writer's colonies that Stephen and I both often go to, this one being Yaddo, at breakfast I was talking to other writers and I asked a novelist the sort of terrible question, what is your novel about? And she said, a couple of disasters and a lot of landscape. And I thought, wow, that's great. That's my title for the day. And I asked her, what are the disasters? And she said, a hurricane and the explosion of a fireworks factory. And I thought, well, I could do something with those. A couple of disasters and a lot of landscape. First, the explosion of the fireworks factory, then the hurricane. First, a tree full of tiny American flags, then no trees at all. A long story needs at least one disaster to show us how people act when they're caught off guard. Whereas the landscape in between is a good place for detail and second thoughts. Yes, she decides. That's why I never answered his letter or went out that night in the rain. The writer knows the trick is always balance. Too much thinking is worse than too much action, except for Proust and many other equally persuasive exceptions, which remind us the best advice exists to be disregarded once it's understood. Aftermath is for the difficult truths. Is that where our house used to be? The wife asks, hoping the answer isn't what she can so clearly see. Many pages torn from a book and a spoon, the umbrella no one ever used, two letters still unopened. All the secrets of debris and everything they mean, if they mean anything, beyond the strangeness of what survives. The mortality of books. Dampness and sunshine are equally fatal. Jackets fade, mildew gathers. Whatever you wipe away will surely return. But now, sliding that last book back in place, you see, the afternoon you first held it in your hands, light through the lace of the trees, and at home the sheen of the table where it lay, proclaiming its beauty. Later, the shelf where it remained, exiled and unread, as if its purpose had always been to remind you of the brevity of what's new. You didn't think about it then. The sun was out. The books were shining in their displays along the avenue, and you were certain you'd fallen in love. Remember that day? Everything was a bargain. And mortality, that was an idea. One word among the others. I'll read three more. This is called I Was Just Wondering. Title kind of goes into the poem. I was just wondering. If the universe keeps expanding, where is it going? And what was here before? Don't tell me nothing. If God made us and was pleased, why did he decide to add the Japanese beetle? Or the deer tick? Or any kind of disease that steals your mind? When did that look like a good idea? And don't tell me there's a plan, but we're not supposed to know how it works. What's the point of guessing? Why should a turtle live 100 years but not a dog, specifically my dog? Why do we sometimes need each other and sometimes not? Don't tell me more happiness wouldn't make as good a story. And if we say we love what fades because it fades, how will we feel when we start to forget? Don't tell me we shouldn't be afraid. One other new one. This is like the one I read at the beginning from a new book that'll be out in a year from this fall called The Life Beside This One. And this poem is called Devotion. It's based on that old kind of morality story, like if your house is burning down, and inside there's one thing, and also, say, a Rembrandt painting, a dog, say, or your grandmother. I think that was the way William Faulkner put it. Your grandmother and the ode on a Grecian urn. Which would you save? I won't answer that question. Now the fire is out of control. On the wall, there's a Rembrandt. And in the desk, a snapshot of your wife. Which do you save? The Rembrandt, of course. And yet, shouldn't there be a grandmother involved? A more difficult moral dilemma? Then imagine that photo's the only one left of your wife, who perished in an earlier fire. Along with all the negatives. Say she was very beautiful. Maybe you're thinking that's irrelevant, but it's not. Beauty is never irrelevant. So you rush back into the burning house, at which point the entire second floor collapses, and you're crushed, grasping for the knob of the drawer. A cruel irony? Not exactly. More like an example of bad timing, as well as a way of suggesting this story has no moral and no point, which is unfortunately often the case with art today, where lack of insight seems easily confused with the world's apparent absence of purpose, a common error, I'm afraid, among the young who are so impatient and thoughtless and beautiful and impossible to save. And the last poem. It's a poem from my wife, Judy, who's not here tonight. It's called What I Should Tell You More Often. If I couldn't hear your voice, no other voice would suffice. If I couldn't listen to your breath as you sleep, how would I know I was still breathing? How could I open my eyes to receive the day? If we forget the same story, what time takes from us, it takes from us both. But if you weren't to return to this room, why would I draw the curtains to divide one darkness from another? Why would I need to make that distinction? What we see together each morning without surprise, how quickly would it vanish? These stones in the garden adding up to a wall, and the grass that has learned where it must end, and the flowers whose names only you have tried to teach me. Thank you.
Wonderful. And just to let you know, there are going to be books available for sale later. Stephen Dunn. I first met Stephen Dunn in the Pine Barrens of New Jersey. Oh, I'm sorry. This is the harder one of the two. And you'll understand why in a moment. Stephen was a creative writing professor at Stockton State College, which is now Stockton University. He was my teacher and my mentor, and little did I know when I first met him when I was 16 years old that he would become a dear lifelong friend. I'll start my introduction by quoting Barry Hardiman, who's an editor for NPR's Weekend Edition, who, when asked to choose one of his favorite author interviews in 2014, picked Stephen Dunn. Referring to his conversation with Stephen, Hardiman said, "It feels as though you are still in the chapel of language that poetry is, but it still feels like a friend is whispering in your ear very wise things." And he had that quality about him. To say that Stephen Dunn has had an amazing career as a poet would be an understatement. 16 books published, that was my fast count, maybe there are more, one of which, Different Hours, won the Pulitzer Prize in 2001. Not to mention many other awards, including the National Book Critics Award, finalist for Loosestrife, and the Patterson Award for Sustained Literary Achievement. Quoting Tony Hoagland once again on Stephen's recently released chapbook, Keeper of Limits, the Mrs. Cavendish Poems, like Freud, Dunn loves to name what nobody says out loud. Like Stevens, Dunn believes that to make things up is the best destiny. In this poetic sequence, all of Stephen Dunn's virtues are manifest. Aphoristic dexterity, psychological wisdom, and his hilarious take on the human comedy. Scouting around earlier today for quotes that might help me do this job tonight of introducing him, I found this from a student who first met Stephen while studying at Interlochen Arts Academy. She wrote, "I remember Stephen Dunn's reading like you remember the first incidental time you meet your future girlfriend, but had no idea at the time how maybe you smiled at each other across the table and texted kindly the next day in a friendly manner, and then boom, 5 months later, you're rehashing that first glance, turning it into legend, turning memory into forecasts. Stephen Dunn is a language now. It's a part of how I talk." My response? I couldn't agree more. I know that I carry the language of Stephen Dunn with me all the time, in my visceral, metaphorical, and physical suitcases, even on my Kindle, as though I've been infused over the years with some proven mix of a life-sustaining and illuminating vitamin Dunn. Present Stephen Dunn.
Well, Madeline, thank you very much. And I want to thank my wonderful sister-in-law, Jo Hurd. For making everything happen, being the wonderful person she is. And I love to follow great readings. That was a great reading. I'm going to start with a very short poem that I put together maybe, I guess, 2 years ago now, my short poems in a little chapbook, 20 short poems. This is the shortest. Giving birth. At my favorite professor's dinner party years ago, I gave birth to what I thought was a new idea. And the room got quiet with tolerance. I still hear that tolerance. I'm going to jump around and read some new poems. This is a book that's, this is the galleys of a book that's going to come out in February. A lot of typos in it, but I know what they are. I'll read through them. And it's a book that's dedicated to Madeline, by the way. Propositions has an epigraph from Randall Jarrell. What does a pig know about bacon? Anyone who begins a sentence with, in all honesty, is about to tell a lie. Anyone who says, this is how I feel, had better love form more than disclosure. Same for anyone who thinks well, who thinks he thinks well because he had a thought. If you say you're ugly to an ugly person, no credit for honesty, which must always be a discovery, an act that qualifies as an achievement. If you persist, you're just a cruel bastard, a pig without a mirror, somebody who hasn't examined himself enough. A hesitation hints at an attempt to be honest, suggests a difficulty is present. A good sentence needs a clause or two, interruptions set off by commas, evidence of a slowing down or rethinking. Before I asked my wife to marry me, I told her I'd never be fully honest. No one, she said, had ever said that to her. I was trying to be radically honest, I said, but in fact had another motive. A claim without a but in it is at best only half true. In all honesty, I was asking in advance to be forgiven. Read one of the new one here. I have the pages written down. For some a mountain. For some a mountain, say an Everest or Kilimanjaro, exists to be conquered, a kind of obvious big thing my father, that valley dweller, would casually diminish. What's wrong with life in the lowlands, he'd say. Why not just look up, enjoy imagining how you'd feel at the top? And interesting people, if you need them, are everywhere. They could be found in a glade or a clearing, even in a suburb. My father is dead. He only has the words I remember and choose to give him. If I were to say my need to define myself involves breathing air not many have taken in and the excitement of a little danger, I'd hear him say, do some good work, mow the lawn, carry wood from the woodpile. Don't confuse the dangerous with the heroic. But the truth is, I'd like to be a mountainizer, someone who earns the pleasure of his reputation. When it comes to women, I desire them married to their own sense of accomplishment, each of us going our own way, coming together when we can. Not enough, he says. If they lack generosity, they take back what they give. If they have it, they remind you ever so gently that a man who climbs mountains leaves behind his beloved. It's impossible to win arguments with the dead. Everywhere you go, there's danger of being a no one, my father insists. Is he changing his position, or is that willful me changing it for my sake? The grave was always his destination, the modesty of his ambition obscured now by lichen and moss. Comes the mountain before the reputation, I say. Comes the unsure footing, the likely fall, he says. If a clown came out of the woods, a standard-looking clown with oversized polka-dot clothes, floppy shoes, and a red bulbous nose, and you saw him on the edge of your property, there'd be nothing funny about that, would there? A bear might be preferable, especially if black and berry-driven. And this clown began waving his hands with those big white gloves that clowns wear, and you realized he wanted something, he wanted your attention, had something apparently urgent to tell you. Would you pivot and run from him, or stay put, as my friend did, who seemed to understand here was a clown who didn't know where he was, a clown without a context? What could be sadder, my friend thought, than a clown in need of a context? If then the clown said to you that he was on his way to a kid's birthday party, his car had broken down and he needed a ride, would you give him one? Or would the connection between the comic and the appalling as it pertained to clowns be suddenly so clear that you'd be paralyzed by it? And if you were the clown and my friend hesitated as he did, would you make a sad face and with an enormous finger wipe away an imaginary tear? How far would you trust your art? I can tell you it worked. Most of the guests had gone when my friend and the clown drove up, and the family was angry. But the clown twisted a balloon into the shape of a bird and gave it to the kid, who smiled, letting it rise to the ceiling. If you were the kid, the birthday boy, what from then on would be your relationship with disappointment, with joy? Whom would you blame or extol? Don't do that. It was bring your own if you wanted anything hard, so I brought Johnny Walker Red, along with some resentment I'd held in for a few weeks, which was not helped by the sight of the little nameless things pierced with toothpicks on the tables, or by talk that promised to be nothing if not small. But I had consented to come, and I knew in what part of the house their animals would be sequestered, whose company I loved. What else can I say except that old retainer of slights and wrongs, that bad boy I hadn't quite outgrown, I brought him along too. I was out to cultivate a mood. My host greeted me, but did not ask about my soul, which is when I was invited by Johnny Walker Red to find the right kind of glass and pour. I toasted the air, I said hello to the wall, then walked past a group of women dressed to be seen, undressing them one by one, and went up the stairs to where the Rottweilers were, Rosie and Tom, and got down with them on all fours. They licked the face I offered them, and I proceeded to slick back my hair with their saliva. And before long, I felt like a wild thing, ready to mess up the party, scarf the hors d'oeuvres. But the dog said, "No, don't do that. Calm down." After a while, they open the door and let you out. They pet your head, and everything you might have held against them is gone, and you're good friends again. "Stay," they said. Well, I've been telling people for years that if you're going to write a love poem, try to write a love poem about a relationship of any duration, it had better have a but in it, or it's a lie. And I still believe that mostly, but I managed with my present wife to write a poem, authentic poem, I think, without a but in it. Here and now for Barbara. There are words I've had to save myself from, like my Lord and Blessed Mother. Words I said and never meant, though I admit a part of me misses the ornamental stateliness of high mass, that smell of incense. Heaven did exist, I discovered, but was reciprocal and momentary, like lust felt at exactly the same time. Two mortals say on a resilient bed, making a small case for themselves. You and I became the words I'd say before I lay me down to sleep, and again when I'd wake, wishful words, no belief in them yet. It seemed you'd been put on earth to distract me from what was doctrinal and dry. Electricity may start things, but if they're to last, I've come to understand. A steady, low-voltage hum of affection must be arrived at. How else to offset the occasional slide into neglect and ill temper? I learned in time to let heaven go its mythy way, to never again be a supplicant to any single idea. For you and me, it's here and now, from here on in. Nothing can save us, nor do we wish to be saved. Let night come with its austere grandeur, ancient superstitions and fears. It can do us no harm. We'll put some music on, open the curtains, let things darken as they will. I don't know if any of you have a time of day when you're most likely to get in trouble. Mine is around 4 o'clock in the afternoon. This poem maybe makes up for the poem I just read. Bad. My wife is working in her room writing, and I've come in 3 times with idle chatter, some not new news. The 4th time she identifies me as what I am, a man lost in late afternoon, in the terrible in-between, good work long over, good drink not yet what the clock has okayed. Her mood a little bemused, leave me the hell alone, mixed with a weary smile, and I see my face up on the post office wall among men least wanted, looking forlorn. In the small print under my name, annoying to loved ones in the afternoons, lacks inner resources. I go away, guilty as charged, and write this poem, which I insist she read at drinking time. She's reading it now. It seems she's pleased, but when she speaks, it's about charm and how predictable I am, how when in trouble, I try to become irresistible, like one of those blonde dogs with a red bandana around his neck. Sorry, he's peed on the rug. Forget it, she says. This stuff is old. It won't work anymore. And I hear, good boy, good boy. And can't stop licking her hand. Shameless poem. Larry mentioned one of those writer's colonies we tend to apply to and get into and go to. A few years ago, I was at one of them, I can't remember, it might have been McDowell, it might have been Yaddo, with a very good poet named Spencer Rees, who was working on a long poem about Hartford, Connecticut, where he grew up, where his mother was, and where Wallace Stevens, of course, spent most of his life. And Spencer was leaving the next day to be ordained as an Anglican priest. I was leaving to go home. He showed me this poem. I wanted to my reaction to it. And I knew something about Wallace Stevens that he didn't know, and which he didn't have in his poem. I decided to tell him it would screw up his poem, I thought. So I told him, and it made the poem really. He incorporated it wonderfully in the poem. It was Stephen's statement that the poet never yields to the priest. And I think the conversation that night resulted in the most ecumenical poem I've ever written. If the poet doesn't yield to the priest as Stephen says he shouldn't, and if both reside in the same village and call on their powers to rectify and explain the latest disaster, does the priest become less persuasive because his ideas are likely not his own? And is the poet suspect for the same reason? Would a good priest find the right words as the good poet would, in among the many words passed down for centuries on what to think, what to believe? Or would reverence always get in the way of the true, thus possibly giving the poet the edge? That is, if the poet mistrusts words, as he should, makes them pass hard tests, knows they must be arranged and shaped in order to convey even a smidgen of truth, wouldn't he, although self-ordained, be more reliable? But what if the villagers believed they were saved by prayer, the priest said, one Sunday morning among the ruins, and all the poet could do was elegize the ruins? Would the real and the imagined fuse become something entirely new? And what if the poet and the priest were one, each invoking the other as the crops grew and rain was steady in rainy season? Or just as confusing, things got worse and prayers proved useless, and poems merely decorated the debris where a house once was? Would it be time for the priest to admit he'd known but one book, for the poet to say he'd read many and look, it hasn't helped? Or has the issue from the start been a great need that can't be fully met, only made bearable and sometimes served by those who try? I'll read about three or four more. This is Ambush at 5 o'clock. We were at the hedge that separates our properties when I asked our neighbors about their souls. I said it with a smile, the way one asks such a thing. They were somewhat like us, I thought, more than middle-aged, less dull than most. Yet they seemed to have no interest in disputation, our favorite game, or any of the great national pastimes like gossip and stories of misfortunes about people they disliked. In spite of these differences, kindred was a word we often felt and used. The man was shy, though came to life when he spotted an uncommon bird, and the woman lively, sometimes even funny about barometer readings and sudden dips in pressure, the general state of things. We liked their affection for each other and for dogs. We went to their house, they came to ours. After I asked about their souls, they laughed and stumbled toward an answer, then gave up, turned the question back to me. And because mine was always in jeopardy, I said it went to the movies and hasn't been seen since. I said gobbly and I said gook. I found myself needing to fool around, avoid, stay away from myself. My wife said her soul suffered from neglect, that she herself was often neglectful of important things, but so was I. Then she started to cry. What's the matter? I asked. What brought this on? She didn't answer. I felt ambushed, publicly insensitive about something, whatever it was. It was a dusky 5 o'clock, the time in between one thing and another. Our neighbors began to retreat to their home. But the woman returned and without a word put her arms around my wife, as if a woman weeping indicated something already understood among women that needn't be voiced. They held each other, rocked back and forth. And I thought, Jesus Christ, am I guilty again? One of those small errors I've repeated until it became large. What about me, I thought? What about the sadness of being stupid? Why doesn't her husband return with maybe a beer and a knowing nod? Whereas the animal I cannot help but be. The possum knows how to play himself as one of us, and the chameleon too can fit right in, be other than it is. I praise them both. And as night rises up from the grass and comes down from the clouds, bats at top speed merely glance off of what they disturb. I admire their swooping gracefulness and the brilliance of moles carving tunnels under lawns, feeling their whiskery way as they go. I even praise the cat, its savage patience and quick paws. I feel a camaraderie with the earthworm, straightforward but slippery, both ends open, getting under the feet of barefoot girls. Unlike you and me, they have no choice. They themselves are evidence of what can be done conspicuously or undercover without remorse. Whereas the animal I cannot help but be, duplicitous, having more than once been taken to task, shamed, still envies the silver fox, leaving a false trail, swerving this way, then that. Let's read two more. Two older ones. Sweetness. Just when it has seemed I couldn't bear one more friend waking with a tumor, one more maniac with a perfect reason, often a sweetness has come and changed nothing in the world except the way I stumbled through it. For a while lost in the ignorance of loving someone or something, the world shrunk to mouth size, hand size, and never seeming small. I acknowledge there is no sweetness that doesn't leave a stain, no sweetness that's ever sufficiently sweet. Tonight a friend called to say his lover was killed in a car he was driving. His voice was low and guttural. He repeated what he needed to repeat, and I repeated the one or two words we have for such grief until we were speaking only in tone. Often a sweetness comes as if on loan, stays just long enough to make sense of what it means to be alive, then returns to its dark source. As for me, I don't care where it's been or what bitter road it's traveled to come so far, to taste so good. Some years ago, I heard or read, I can't remember now, an interview with John Ashbery, in which the interviewer asked a very strange question, which was why he didn't write more poems about the occult, to which he said it wasn't strange enough. Which seemed like just the right answer. Not the occult. I'll finish with this. Because I was slow with girls and didn't understand they might like to be touched, my girlfriend took my hand and placed it on her breast. We were 16. I just left it there as if I were memorizing, which in fact I was. It was all research and dreams, some fabulous connection between my hand and her breathing. And I was breathing like that too. I've always been drawn to such ordinary mysteries, women and men, the broken bridge between us. I like thinking about night falling in a house where anything can happen and has. Strangers coming in from their public outposts, the drift of history behind any wish to explain. How to say what can't be said across a table or bed. It's not the occult and those obvious stakes in the heart that make me wonder. I confess I have trouble speaking to people fond of outer space. I don't like riddles. I'm tired of ambiguities, old academic hush. Still, things happen, and simply to record them is often to deceive, is even sometimes to mimic fog, the way it's perfectly yet inadequately clear about itself. I'm thinking of that woman returning from the restroom, unable to recognize her husband. She wasn't old, he hadn't disappeared, though she perhaps had lost him. "Where's my husband?" she asked the waiter, who pointed toward the table. I'm thinking of the time we lay ourselves down among the dwarf pines, looked up at the sky. Nothing was new up there, and down here, the words for love stuck in their history of abuse. "Angel," I wanted to say, meaning darling. It seems heroic how we survive each other, heroic that we try. I'm thinking of the power of loveliness to sadden. Well, once there was such awe, such a pure desire to praise. It's not one of us who inspires as much. But I love the local and crude, somehow made beautiful, all the traces of how it got that way erased. And I love the corporeal body itself, designed to fail, and the mind, the helpless mind, so often impelled to think about it. Thank you.